I'm Alice.
And I'm Brett.
And this is The Prosecutor's Legal Blues. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Alice, and I'm joined, as always, by my duplicitous co-host, Brett.
Wow, duplicitous. That's a bad thing, I think.
It kind of is. Except it's on point for our theme today, which is...
Is it?
Dual juries.
I think then I would be duplicative, not duplicitous. But that's okay. That's okay. I'll just live with it.
But you're not duplicative because you are one of a kind.
Right.
But sometimes there's so many facets of who you are that we can't exactly tell what you are. So I think of it as having many facets to you rather than it being a negative thing, Brett.
Okay. 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 So this is why you're a good lawyer, Alice, because you, you're good at making BS arguments that nevertheless sound good. So we're just gonna go with it. But yes, Alice, we are talking about dual juries, which I will just go ahead and admit to you. I made it through 3 years of law school, and let's see, I've been a lawyer now for 15 years, and I had no idea what that was. Had never heard of that before.
Me too, Brett. It had never crossed my mind that you could have two juries. I thought, okay, maybe in different jurisdictions for different charges. Of course, you can have multiple juries. But, of course, our amazing listeners and our amazing fans always bring us the most interesting legal cases and the most interesting legal questions. So someone actually in the gallery, I believe, our Facebook fan page, brought this to our attention. And both of us were like, this can't be true. They must have read this incorrectly. There are no two juries for one case.
Yeah, when they brought it up, I was like, what are you talking about? I don't know what you're talking about, but you've clearly got this wrong. And then they sent an article about it. And I was like, oh, wow. So we decided if this is a thing that exists and we don't even know about it, this would be something that might be interesting to you guys. And it has a practical might be a little strong. I don't think you're going to be able to use this in your everyday life, but it's in the news right now. So it's perfect for us to talk about on Legal Briefs. A lot of you guys have been following the Kristen Smart case and the trial that's about to happen in literally a couple weeks of Paul Flores and his father, Ruben Flores. And this trial is going to have an interesting twist. For those of you who haven't been following this, Paul Flores is accused of murdering Kristen Smart in 1996, and his father, Ruben, is accused of helping him cover it up. Interesting side note about the Kristen Smart case, it has a sort of weird connection to the Peterson trial. Scott Peterson was at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo at the same time as Kristen Smart. So when Scott was accused of killing his wife, of course, people sort of looked back into his background to see if he had ever done anything like that before, because it seemed like such a vicious crime to kill your pregnant wife that it wouldn't be the kind of thing where this was your first time being a violent murderer. And the Kristen Smart case was famous. It was a disappearance of a young woman who also attended the school who everyone assumed was dead, and suspicion sort of fell on Scott Peterson for, you know, a hot moment. It didn't take long before people realized that he really didn't have anything to do with it. Interestingly, this has kind of come back up as the Flores case gets underway. His defense lawyers have indicated that they may actually want to call Scott Peterson. And this is the kind of thing that clearly is intended to confuse the jury and create some sort of Hollywood drama in this case. Scott Peterson did not kill Kristen Smart. And it's pretty clear who did, and that is Paul Flores. But we'll see what happens in the trial. In any event, Kristen Smart, this is not going to be the first time you've ever heard of this case. This is a case that's always been famous in true crime, and it was the work of a true crime podcast called Your Own Backyard, hosted by Chris Lambert, that finally brought the case to a point where it could be tried. Lambert did a lot of investigation. He dug up a lot of evidence. He brought attention back to a case that was a very cold case, 1996. That's a long time for a case to go unsolved and to have a trial happening here 25 years later because of the work of a podcast really is amazing and just goes to show why we always try and highlight some of these old cases and see if there's anything out there and anybody out there who might have information, because you never know.
No, that's absolutely right. And, you know, actually, many of you have asked us before, have any podcasts, true crime podcasts, help bring closure or an answer to an unsolved case? And this is a great example of someone kind of using their voice on the air for good to bring justice for Kristen Smart in this case.
Now, no good deed goes unpunished, and it wouldn't shock me if Mr. Lambert ends up having to testify in this trial. But nevertheless, he did a lot of great work. And if there is a conviction in this case, he deserves a lot of the credit. But while that is all very interesting, and one day we might want to do an entire series on the Kristen Smart case, that is not what we're going to be talking about today. There is something from a legal perspective in this case, and we've already told you a little bit about it, that is even more intriguing. Paul and Ruben Flores will have one trial, but that one trial will have two juries, one for each of them. Yes, it turns out, as shocked as I was the first time I ever heard about it, this is a real thing. And once you look into it, you realize, even though it's pretty rare, it's been used in some famous cases before. Probably the most famous case is that of the Menendez brothers, Lyle and Eric Menendez, who were accused and eventually convicted of killing their parents. Though it took three juries to get them to that point, their first trial had one of these dual jury things, and both of them deadlocked, which is a remarkable thing, actually. They actually retried them with one jury, and that one jury did convict them. So why does this happen, and how does it work? Well, first of all, this is another one of those jurisdiction-to-jurisdiction things. The federal jurisdiction does allow this, which also surprised me, but it does, and a lot of states do. Some states have never really dealt with it directly, but California is one of the states that has used this before. The Menendez trial is an example. Now, this is important. It is not the case that every time you have more than one defendant, you have multiple juries. In fact, it happens all the time that multiple defendants are tried together. And if you had multiple juries every time you had multiple defendants, this would have been something we all would have heard about, because we would have seen it again and again and again. But when you have one crime, and you have multiple defendants, and you have one jury, there is a constitutional rule that can cause you some complications. It's called Bruton, and it involves everyone's favorite rule of evidence, hearsay.
Hearsay. So here's a problem for you to think about. You're on trial with your co-defendant. You were smart. When you were arrested, you listened to the cops about that whole anything you can say can and will be used against you thing, and you kept your mouth shut. Your buddy, though, who you were arrested with, he didn't listen to as many true crime podcasts as you did, and he said something to the police he shouldn't have. And now both of you are headed to trial. Neither of you are going to testify. The prosecution plans on using your co-defendant's statements against him. It's an out-of-court statement about the truth of the matter asserted. So it is classic hearsay, but that's okay, because there's an exception. It's a statement of a party opponent, so therefore it comes in. All that means is if you say something and you are a party to the case, you can use it even if it's for the truth of the matter asserted. After all, if he didn't want it used against him, he shouldn't have opened his big mouth.
And let's stop for just one second here, because just in case you guys didn't listen to our hearsay discussion, I think that was in the Square Grouper case. Tara Rosado and Carlos Ortiz. We did a whole thing on hearsay and what hearsay is. But just real quick, in case you don't know. So hearsay, all hearsay means is a statement that was made outside of court that one party wants to bring in for its truth. So let's say that the statement is, I killed that SOB, right? So the prosecution, they want to bring that statement in and they want to use it to prove that you killed that SOB, right? So that's hearsay because it's an out-of-court statement. And if somebody else wants to testify that they heard you say that out of court, and if it's going to come in, it has to have an exception because hearsay, generally speaking, doesn't come in. Right? We don't allow hearsay because we want to hear from the witness. We want to hear from the person. We want to hear from the person who said it. We don't want to hear from somebody else who heard the person say it. Right? So ordinarily, we don't want hearsay statements to come in. There is an exception, though. One of the exceptions is if it's a party opponent. So if it's the other person, you're the prosecution, it's something the defendant said, that is an exception to hearsay. So even though it's an out-of-court statement, made for the truth of the matter asserted, that's why you want to put it into evidence, because it was made by a party opponent, it can come in, no hearsay problem.
That was an awesome summary. Definitely go listen to the Grouper episode on our other podcast, The Prosecutors, if you want to hear a more fulsome discussion by Professor Brett, who actually has taught evidence and hearsay for his students before. And so that was a great explanation, Brett. So now that you guys are all experts in hearsay, you understand that your co-defendant's out-of-court statement, though hearsay, can come in because he is a party opponent in this case. But what about you? You were smart and you didn't open your mouth, and now this statement made by your co-defendant is going to be entered into evidence. Your co-defendant isn't testifying, so you cannot cross-examine him to attack the statement or prove that it was coerced or false. Remember, the reason hearsay is generally not allowed in court is because you as the defendant have the right to confront anyone who accuses you. So any witness who's testifying against you, you have the right to cross-examine them. The prosecution gets to do that to the defense's witnesses as well. In other words, testimony on the stand gets to be tested. It doesn't just get to be this perfectly edited, you know, written statement that you've worked on and no one gets to poke and prod holes in it. You get to cross-examine generally anyone who makes a statement that is evidence. But because of this party opponent exception to hearsay, you don't get to cross-examine your co-defendant and show that maybe there are problems with what he said. Maybe he was under the influence of drugs. Maybe there was no way he could have known the things that he was talking about because he was in another room or another location. There's no way he would have known those things. You can't bring any of it out. So the statement essentially goes unchallenged. Now, if you call your co-defendant as a witness, he can simply assert his constitutional Fifth Amendment rights against testifying against himself. The judge says, that's okay. I'll just tell the jury not to consider his statement explaining exactly how you both committed the crime against you in deliberations. In other words, have the judge give some limiting instruction that says, your co-defendant said this statement, jury, only consider this statement for the co-defendant and not for you. Now, would you feel like this was fair? Or would you feel like your rights were being violated because of someone else's statement that you don't get to challenge comes in? Even if the judge says, don't consider it for Alice, only consider it for her co-defendant, even though the statement mentions Alice.
And you can just imagine, you know, how this all comes in. You get the police officer gets up on the stand, and he says, yeah, Brett said that he and Alice went to the bank, and Brett, he was the one in the getaway car, and Alice went in with the gun and the note, and she came running out with a bag of money, and she jumped in the car, and she said, go, 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 we get away before the cops get here. And then we arrested them both, and that's when he gave this fully incriminating statement, right? I mean, just imagine the police officer saying that about what your co-defendant said. You are completely sunk. Right? I mean, you have no chance. And it doesn't really matter what a judge says to the jury. The judge can tell the jury all day, don't consider anything that he said about Alice when you are deliberating, right? But juries are made up of human beings. They can't just turn off their brain. Ordinarily, a judge's instruction actually is considered binding. If the judge gives an instruction to the jury, then the presumption is that the jury followed it, even if it's a presumption that stretches the imagination at times. There are often times where you're like, man, I don't know if a jury can really just disregard that. And that's a big one, right? You ask a question, it gets answered. There's an objection, move to strike. The judge strikes the answer and says, jury, disregard what the witness just said. Well, the presumption is the jury will disregard what they said, right? But you can imagine that that's a little bit of a legal fiction because these are still people and it's really hard for them to do that, even if they're trying. And this is about as bad as it gets. It's hard to imagine anything more damning than your co-defendant's confession. And then you get up to cross-examine the cop and you're like, well, how did he know it was Alice, or what was his state of mind when he gave you this statement? The cop's like, I don't know. Seemed fine to me. Seemed perfectly reasonable to me, right? I mean, the police officer, number one, can't actually speak to anything that was going through your co-defendant's mind at the time. And number two, isn't interested in answering your questions in any way that might undermine the statement. So you really have no opportunity at all to get at the statement itself. It's just coming in through this hearsay exception, and you're just out of luck. And for a long time, that was just the way it was. But then Bruton comes along. So Bruton and his co-defendant, Evans, were convicted in 1966 of armed postal robbery. And much like in our example, the two men were caught and Evans confessed. Eventually, there's a trial. Both men go to trial. They are tried together. And the judge orders that the statement that Evans gave was a freely made statement, knowing his rights, and it could come in against him. But he gave a limiting instruction to the jury that they were to disregard Evans' confession as to Bruton. Both men were convicted, and Bruton appealed, claiming that his right to confront his accuser, in this case, his own co-defendant, under the Sixth Amendment had been violated by the admission of the confession in trial. As Alice pointed out, he can't call him to the stand. I mean, that would normally be the way you could cure that, right? If you have a statement coming in from someone, you call him to the stand, you ask him questions about the statement. But he can't do that here because it's his co-defendant. His co-defendant has an absolute right not to testify. He's already talked too much. He certainly doesn't want to talk more, right? I mean, if his co-defendant testifies with his confession out there, this is going to be murder for him. So he's never going to testify. Now, interestingly, this issue had been raised before in a case called Deli Paoli. But in that case, the Supreme Court had held that the judge's instruction was sufficient. So you had this constitutional rule that under the Sixth Amendment, the judge's limiting instruction was sufficient to protect the Sixth Amendment right of the non-confessing defendant. So you had right on point Supreme Court precedent here. But there had been a strong dissent in the case of four justices. So you had a 5-4 Supreme Court decision here. And now the minority had become the majority. So the people who had dissented now have added a couple more justices, and those guys are on their side. So the Supreme Court decides to overrule this prior precedent, Deli Paoli, and held that no judicial instruction was sufficient to overcome the prejudice done to a defendant by admitting his statement when he himself did not testify. If he testified, then cross-examination is possible. You can confront him, but once again, you can't force him to testify. And if he's not going to testify, statement can't come in. And the court explained that there are certain contexts in which the harm is simply too great to ignore, even if you have one of these limiting instructions. And here's what they said. Such a context is presented here, where the powerfully incriminating extrajudicial statements of a co-defendant who stands accused side by side with the defendant are deliberately spread before the jury in a joint trial. Not only are the incriminations devastating to the defendant, but their credibility is inevitably suspect, a fact recognized when accomplices do take the stand and the jury is instructed to weigh their testimony carefully, given the recognized motivation to shift blame onto others. The unreliability of such evidence is intolerably compounded when the alleged accomplice, as here, does not testify and cannot be tested by cross-examination. It was against such threats to a fair trial that the Confrontation Clause was directed.
So what is the practical effect? First, co-defendant statements don't come in unless the co-defendant testifies. Now, some of you remember the West Memphis 3 documentary Paradise Lost. In that case, Jesse Miskelly was tried separately from Damian Echols and Jason Baldwin. The reason for that was that Jesse had confessed and inculpated Damian and Jason in the crime. You may also recall that there was a whole discussion about whether Jesse would testify in the later trial. The reason for that was unless he testified, his statement could not come in as a result of this case.
And that was never explained in the documentary. And I'm sure some of you wondered why. I mean, it was something they repeated again and again. If he doesn't testify, his confession doesn't come in. And you probably wondered why that was. Well, this is the reason. Unless he's going to testify, unless he's going to subject himself to cross-examination, none of that stuff is going to come in against his co-defendants. And they're still his co-defendants, even though they're being tried separately.
Absolutely. So there you have it. You have the reason as to why that was the case. Now, sometimes you can redact prior statements so that they only incriminate the maker of the statement. In that case, you can get the statement in just like any other piece of evidence. But what about when you can't do that? Or when the evidence is so extensive and intertwined that it's impossible to separate it out. Kind of like Brett's story of if he were arrested and he told them about how he was in the getaway car and I was in the bank and I got in the car and told him to go, go, go. The stories are so intertwined about both of our involvement that could you really separate out the part where he talks about me? Well, in that instance, you have three options. First, you can see whether you can go forward without all of the evidence. Second, you can try the people separately, which is expensive and time consuming. Or in rare cases, you can have two juries. What brings us to the topic of today's Legal Briefs episode.
Yeah, and you can imagine why it really is probably the least popular choice, even though it happens all the time. But the choice that gives every prosecutor a headache is having to try the case twice. I mean, having to try any case twice is bad, but you can just imagine it's just like, oh my goodness, we got to do this once, and then we got to call all the same witnesses and show all the same evidence and do this again with a different person. And nobody wants to do that, right? Nobody wants to do that. And so you really try and figure out a way not to have to do it. And it'd probably surprise you how often some really good evidence like confessions don't come in just because the state does not want to have to try the case twice. I mean, it probably happens more than you would think where that doesn't come in because it's really that kind of evidence that you're worried about. It's not other stuff. Videotape of both of you in the car, for instance, that's coming in. That's not what we're talking about. It has to be something like this where one of you has said something to somebody at some point, and it's not necessarily a confession. It can be other out-of-court statements. I mean, maybe you talked to a third party and you said some incriminating things to the third party. It could be something like that. And you really just have to sort of narrow it down and figure out whether it falls into one of these Bruton categories and whether it can be narrowed down just to the person. Like Alice said, if what you told the third person was, man, did you see about that bank robbery? I was totally involved in that, right? Well, that's fine. Now, is it good for you as the co-defendant if your co-defendant has said something that makes him guilty? No, it's not. Obviously, the jury is probably going to take you two as a package. And we talked about the West Memphis 3. Y'all probably remember in that case with Jason Baldwin and Damian Echols. I mean, there was all sorts of evidence against Damian, right? There wasn't much evidence against Jason at all, but it felt very much like a package deal. If they found Damian guilty, they were going to find Jason guilty. And that may practically be true. And so practically speaking, your co-defendant's self-incriminatory statement might be really bad for both of you. But if it doesn't actually inculpate you, it's probably not a Bruton statement and it's probably going to be able to come in. But having said all that, what about when you do have this situation and you don't want to try it twice? That brings us to our topic today, which is these joint juries. So how is this going to work? Okay, so when you have two juries, you're going to have both juries present for most evidence. So you're going to have this one trial, you're going to have two different jury selections, which in of itself sounds like a nightmare, particularly for a murder trial. This is probably going to take forever. And so you'll have one jury veneri. I don't think we decide how or what we're going to call that. Veneri.
I think most veneer of the world is veneer. But okay. Us down here south, mm-hmm, say veneri.
Anyways, you're going to bring in two groups of people. You're going to have a group of, say, 50 jurors, right? You got to get down to 12 jurors and probably two alternates, maybe three alternates if it's a famous case. So you're going to ask them a bunch of questions. One day we'll do a whole show on jury selection, but you're going to get down to a jury, and then you're going to have that jury. And that jury will be Paul's jury. So that jury is going to decide the guilt or innocence of Paul Flores. They will then go off to their jury room. Then you'll bring in another group of people. And Ruben Flores and his lawyers and the prosecutors will get up, and they will do the same thing with this group, and they will pick their jury. And then that jury will go off to its jury room. The two juries will never speak to each other. They will never interact in any way. They will sit on opposite sides of the courtroom. They will not deliberate together. They will deliberate separately. It's as if the other jury doesn't even exist. So each person has their own jury. But when evidence is coming in against one of the defendants, say an incriminating statement, right? So you say you have an incriminating statement that incriminates both of them. So say that, for the sake of argument, that Paul made a statement that incriminates him and his father. Say he says, yeah, I killed her and my dad helped cover it up, right? Which is about as incriminating of his father as it could possibly be. Well, his father's jury will not be in the room. The jury will be excluded for that testimony. Only Paul's jury will be in the room. Then that statement made by Paul incriminating both of them will come in so that Paul's jury can consider it. But because of Bruton, the other jury, the jury deciding the fate of his father, will never hear that statement. And that way, this confrontation clause problem never comes in. And so then, after that evidence is dealt with, then the other jury will come back in and it'll just continue. And that way, as you're presenting the evidence, you're only having to present it once. So if it's evidence that would be admissible in either person's trial, it comes in front of both juries. If it's evidence that would only be admissible in one person's trial, then the other jury will be out of the room for that presentation of that evidence. And you'll do that until all the evidence is presented, and then both juries will go to their own rooms, and without ever talking to each other, they will decide the guilt or innocence of their particular defendant.
And that actually makes so much sense, Brett, which is why I'm shocked I didn't know that you could have two juries for multiple defendants. But this makes a lot of sense and conserves a lot more resources for both the court and for the prosecution, because they don't have to do the exact same trial back to back two times.
I bet the vast majority of judges have no idea that you can do this. I bet this is something that really, I mean, like I said, they don't teach you this in law school, and this wasn't on the bar exam. So this is really fascinating to me, but it does. It makes a ton of sense. I mean, you can see why you would do this and how it works practically. It really does cure that problem, and you only have to try the case once. And think about it from the, you know, we talked about it from the perspective of prosecutors because we're selfish and that's what we think about. But think about victims, right? I mean, imagine it's a rape case and you have a victim who's going to have to get on the stand and relive this traumatic violation, and they're going to do it because they want justice. Well, if you have multiple defendants, just imagine if you had multiple trials and you're having to do that over and over and over again, how traumatic that's going to be and how re-victimizing that's going to be. And allowing that person to only have to testify once in one trial, that's great. I mean, that's not only conserving resources, but is taking the victim into account as well.
And that makes so much sense. You know, I just sat through another trial where there are a lot of victims of young women who had been through some atrocities. And we had, you know, a lot of victim advocates there with us and kind of lots of just resources for these young women who had endured a lot of trauma, and they had to recount the trauma under oath. And it took a lot. I mean, we're talking weeks of preparation to get them to a place emotionally where they felt comfortable being on the stand. And as soon as they came down, you know, almost every single one of them said, I'm so glad that's over. I don't think I could ever do that again. And imagine if you were the prosecution, you had to turn to them and say, hey, thank you for you reliving the worst days of your life on that stand. We're going to need you to come back next week and do it again. I mean, that would just be devastating for many of these victims who may decide that they would rather just not, you know, come forward at all because they just can't keep reliving their trauma. So there are a lot of good externalities that come from this procedural fix to the Bruton issue. But We hope you all have learned something, because we certainly learned something. And this just goes to show you, we certainly don't know everything in the law. We are far, far, far from knowing everything. And we love it when you guys bring us interesting legal questions like this one. So keep them coming. We love hearing about them and researching them and learning about them. And that is your legal fix for this week. Before we sign off, Brett, do you have anything to add?
I don't think so. Just, we definitely don't know everything, and we love hearing from you guys, and we love it when you guys give us these ideas. And hey, I'm going to remember this, and maybe one day, Alice, we can try and do one of these cases with two juries and see how it works out.
I guess so. I'm too tired right now to do another trial, but but with you, I'll do anything, Brett. Thank you guys for joining us for this episode of Legal Briefs. Until next time, I'm Alice.
And I'm Brett.
And this is the Prosecutor's Legal Briefs.
So why does this happen, and how does it work?
Do you want me to go?
No, sorry.
It's okay. I don't know, Brett. Why don't you tell us?
Sorry. I'm a little off. I'm a little off my game.
You couldn't be better. The official story is it's not sewage, but I will tell you it smelled like sewage.
When it starts raining sewage in your office, you know that's a bad sign. It's time for me to head for the sunset, I think.
End times.
End times. The end times are here.